Would the clerk call the next case, please?
The court will now call South Texas Innovations versus Ryan Residential Construction. May it please the court, Mr. Miller Johnson to argue for the appellant, Ms. Andrea Barassa to argue for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Miller Johnson. I'm with the law firm of Johnson, DeLuca, Kariski, Gould, and Houston. It's my profound privilege to make my first appearance after 35 years in the Second Court of Appeals. So I appreciate being here today. Our firm represents South Texas Innovations, LLC. That is a concrete subcontractor on a project. And unlike the prior case where we talked about the law completely, this case, I think the law is pretty well settled. It's a question of how you apply it. In this case, our firm represented a subcontractor, represents presently a subcontractor who provided concrete services to a job that, in which the appellees, GRC and LACAR, on the one hand, was the owner-developer. The other appellee, RISE, was the general contractor. Our client, South Texas, or I'm going to call them STI, had contracts with both of those companies. And like RISE Construction, who sued GRCE to get paid, our client intervened in the case to get paid as well. So what we have here is a lawsuit that was filed by Appley RISE in September of 2016 against Appley GRCE and LACAR to seek payment for it's a multifamily residential project in Little Elm, Texas that was being constructed. STI intervened in that case, and at that point the parties went off to see if they could get the case arbitrated, and the case was abated. There is some question in the record as to what the cause of the failure of arbitrating that was. It's been attributed to my client.
Yeah, are you saying that it's unknown or inaccurate that STI refused to participate in the arbitration?
I'm not saying it's inaccurate. I don't know the basis upon which STI refused. It may have been that there were no arbitration provisions in the contract, but that's not in the record. What I do know is that in May of 2017, the appellees moved the trial court to unabate the case and move it back. An order was signed in mid-July, and 2 weeks later, 14 days later, RISE sent a series of requests for admissions to STI.
Now, before those requests for admissions were sent, it's my understanding that your firm had communicated with other counsel indicating that your firm was about to make an appearance in the case, but that didn't happen until November.
That's correct. That's correct. And, Your Honor, the issues with prior counsel, Mr. Tagmeyer, raise, I know, difficult issues for all of us in the profession. And I don't believe anybody, even in July, understood the gravity of what was going on with Mr. Tagmeyer. We were approached by the clients, would you be willing to take over these cases? As part of our due diligence, Mr. Abreu in my office reached out to one of the counsel. It occurred to me last night, and I don't know in this environment today, in 2016, I'm kind of old, I would have normally made this analogy 5 years ago and we thought nothing of it. So if I offend, I apologize in the hashtag Me Too world. I do not mean to offend members of this panel, but we were not counsel in this case until November. And the only analogy I can address that makes sense to me professionally is a person is not partially pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. We were not counsel of record until November. We did not substitute until November. There were a multitude of cases involved in which Mr. Abreu was investigating the claims.
Right, but it's my understanding that it wasn't that your firm substituted in even in November. You just entered an appearance, and I'm assuming that that's because Mr. Tagmeyer was uncooperative or unreachable. But Mr. Abreu had indicated at the end of June that your firm was going to make an appearance.
It's actually July, Your Honor.
July, sorry.
But the fact is that we didn't, number one, and the appellees can't have it both ways here. On the one hand, they want to say, well, you contacted us. Well, we didn't make an appearance. And because we didn't make an appearance, they didn't send our firm the request for admissions that were, and I'm going to get to this, clearly designed to be merits preclusive.
As a lot of requests for admissions are.
Yes, but in this situation where a death penalty sanction is involved, it's a different analysis. The second thing is we didn't get notice of the motion for summary judgment. So from our viewpoint, Mr. Tagmeier was still counsel of record. We did not know what was going on with him. We were talking to the client about possibly stepping in. And then just before the summary judgment hearing, we became aware that there were summary judgments pending, that there was going to be a hearing, and that they were based on deemed admissions.
And that's all they were based on, right?
That's it.
There wasn't, addition to that, there was summary judgment evidence that conclusively proved or anything like that. It was merely based on admissions.
And that's the situation we're in. What happened at the trial court level was a death penalty sanctioned for a lawyer being incapacitated due to mental illness. Let's don't lose sight of that. This is the only place I know where in America where we don't protect people who have a disability due to mental illness. What the effect of the trial court's decision was to punish the client to do a merits preclusive summary judgment based on deemed admissions, based upon the fact the lawyer who's handling the case did not have capacity.
Well, you kind of leave it off of another factor.
Yes, sir.
And that's the hurricane.
Yes, sir. I didn't lead off with that, but I'm happy to talk about it because I'm offended by the reply briefs. I live in Meyerland. I live 10 blocks north of Braze Bio. I'm the only house that sits on grade in Section 2 of Meyerland that didn't have a foot of water in it. It lapped up against my slab, but I didn't get water in it. But their argument is, well, that storm occurred at the end of August. I'm sorry, kids, but it incapacitated our city for the entire rest of the year.
It might have, but Mr. Tagmeier's declaration is pretty sparse he says that the hurricane caused catastrophic damage in Meyerland and it affected his depression, but he didn't say that the hurricane precluded him from doing work.
I happen to know Brian Tagmeier. His wife worked for my law firm about 20 years ago, for about 3 or 4 years. I knew him as a young lawyer. I admire him for being able to sign that affidavit when he signed it, because he's made a matter of public record his mental illness. He's made a public record that hopefully his children won't become lawyers someday and read the record that he had ideations of killing himself for months. And so I really respect that. We did the best we could getting an affidavit from that man, and that's what we did. Let's talk about what we're really looking at. This is a death penalty sanction. And under the law, death penalty sanctions are pretty serious. Transamerican sets it out. It was not a deemed admissions case, but there are a whole slew of deemed admissions cases coming forward. And the trial court's analysis is based on, we review that on a basis of abuse of discretion, but it's not whether this court thinks that given the facts, the court made a correct decision. That's not the rule. Sire, the Texas Supreme Court in 2004, said the test for abuse of discretion is not whether in the opinion of the reviewing court the facts presented an appropriate case for its action, that is, did he do the right thing, but rather whether the court acted without reference to any guiding rules or principles. And those guiding rules and principles are the controlling issue in this case, because in order to issue death penalty sanctions, there have to be findings. I commend the court to look at the court's order denying our motion to withdraw the deemed admissions. There's not a single finding. There is no reference to any guiding principle. There's no mention. The court in Transamerican, citing the United States Supreme Court, says there are constitutional safeguards on the power of the courts, even in aid of their own valid processes, to dismiss an action without affording a hearing on the merits. And that's what happened. The timetable was like this. November 8th, we learn of this. November 9th, we make an appearance and file a motion to continue the hearing. As soon as we get before the court, we ask for leave to file a response to the motion for summary judgment and file an amended motion to withdraw the deemed admissions so that we have the opportunity to put on evidence to get an affidavit from Mr. Dagmire. That was heard all on the same day on December 15th. The trial court granted us leave to file the response. That response had 18 different exhibits, two contracts, one with each of the appellees, a host of notices for non-payment and the statutory notice required for lien, copies of the liens, the amended lien when we did more work, another amended lien, and then an affidavit from Mr. Heyman, the principal of STI, that authenticated all those documents and authenticated the aged AR report showing that these folks owed STI approximately $1 million. So the district court has in front of it the affidavit of Mr. Tagmire, he has the affidavit of Mr. Abreu, and he has the affidavit of Mr. Heyman. And he has to look at those from a death penalty constitutional due process standpoint, and he has to, according to the law, make reference to guiding principles in order to sustain the death penalty sanction. And that order doesn't do it. It's defective on its face, number one. Number two, discovery sanctions cannot be used to adjudicate the merits of a party's claims or defenses unless a party's hindrance of the discovery process justifies a presumption that its claims or defenses lack merit. Those 18 exhibits actually determined a prima facie case for a breach of contract and how much money was owed. So let's figure out what we're doing here. Our client was moving to get paid. We're not a defendant seeking to hold off or not pay or to delay the process. We were a claimant. We put on for the court, and he accepted it, this evidence. But then he said, I'm not going to undeem the admissions.
What in your mind would have been the appropriate or inappropriate?
Yeah, well, Rule 215 has the lesser included sanctions that a court must look at before awarding a death penalty sanction, and he did not.
Which would include?
A monetary award for going through the trouble of preparing the motions, for example. The cases say that if there's good cause and there's not undue prejudice, well, Mr. Tagmire's affidavit, I submit, in our world, in our profession, in our business where stress is a serious problem already, Mr. Tagmire's affidavit establishes good cause.
So the undue prejudice would be undone by the reward, the award of attorney's fees for the time and effort it took to go through the process of filing motion for summary judgment, responding to the motion to undeem the admissions, et cetera.
That's correct, because at the end of the day, the undue prejudice isn't to allow them to escape liability. It puts the parties back to say, okay, we have a dispute here. Who owes what? And that's all it is. Nobody's, you know, sure they've been prejudiced. They're maybe back on the hook. But that's not the prejudice we're talking about. It's simply to compensate them for the time and effort necessary to get the party there. And that's what the trial court should do. That's what Rule 215 says with regard to death penalty sanctions. That's what the Texas Supreme Court says in multiple cases. I think that's what this court said in N. Ray Gunn, that Justice Meyer, I think, sat on. You know, there are lesser included sanctions that must be considered. In N. Ray Gunn, the court said that a death penalty sanction must be set aside unless there's flagrant bad faith or callous disregard of the rules. And in this case, you cannot say that there was flagrant bad faith on the part of a gentleman who is having ideations of killing himself. You just cannot. This court cannot do that. We as a profession cannot do that to our peers. This man was sick. And when you have a mental illness, that just can't be the case. It says callous disregard for the rules. Again, at that point in his life, he didn't have regard for himself, but that didn't mean he was considering what was transpiring in this case or what the effect would be. There is no evidence of callous disregard for the rules. So that brings us to the party. The party Mr. Hayman, in his affidavit, identifies he didn't know about the motion, he didn't know about the request for admissions. You can't say he disregarded that which he does not consciously know.
But isn't there evidence in the record that the client was made aware that there were some issues with Mr. Tagmeier?
Yeah.
Before the request for admissions were served?
There are. And the question is what are the issues? I mean, he's non-responsive. I think people knew he was non-responsive in July. I had a dear friend who was an alcoholic, and we were always afraid to address her. We weren't sure where we should get involved, or we didn't know what the proper way to deal with him was. And it went on for years until one night before a Fifth Circuit argument, he fell down drunk in his hotel room and busted his head wide open. And we thought, well, maybe we should have said something. The world's not perfect. He was aware it was a problem. Mr. Tagmeier had represented STI for a period of time before that. He knew he was not responsive. He had talked to our firm about perhaps taking over these cases. Mr. Abreu was doing some due diligence about whether that was going to happen and whether we could do it. We did not appreciate, no one appreciated in the beginning in July when he was terribly sick and then leading to a hospitalization, and then a hospitalization later in November, how sick Mr. Tagmeier was. I mean, the appellees, I believe, referred to Mr. Tagmeier's Facebook page and say, well, he was showing happy face on the Facebook page. Well, who among us doesn't do that? I mean, I've kind of figured out that the Facebook page is where everybody puts their holiday pictures and look how great my life is. But the truth of the matter is not everybody on Facebook's having a great day.
Thank you. Your time is up.
My apologies.
Would you add 2 minutes to Ms. Barresa's time, please?
Thank you. May it please the court? My name is Andrea Barresa, and I'm with the law firm of Sheep and Stone. I have a colleague, a new associate with me, Walker Young, today, who's here to observe the oral argument. And we're here on behalf of DCRE and LCAR. Also here is Logan Adcock. He is separate counsel for the co-appellee RISE. And because the appellee's issues are essentially parallel, I'll be presenting the argument for all of the appellees. I would agree with counsel that Texas law on this issue is pretty well settled. We know the standard of review, we know the text of the rule, and we know what the standards are. And so the question really does become whether or not the movement and non-movements on the motion to withdraw the deemed admissions met their respective burdens. So what we have is a summary judgment that was heavily supported by deemed admissions. We agree that the summary judgment motions do in fact turn on whether or not the trial court properly denied the motion to withdraw the deemed admissions, but we disagree with counsel on whether or not the movement satisfied its burden in moving to withdraw those admissions, and our showing of bad faith and conscious disregard as a threshold for establishing a trial court's ability and discretion to deny the motion.
Isn't the gist of your position that you just don't believe Tagmeier, that he was going through as bad an ordeal as it's been portrayed?
I believe that that's one point that we do believe weighs in our favor. It's not dispositive. I believe that the record evidence is more than sufficient grounds for the motion to have been denied based on the conduct of the actual party and its new counsel. I would like to just discuss briefly how I interpret the Texas Supreme Court's case law on conscious disregard and bad faith, because my interpretation differs from the briefing that was submitted by the appellant. So under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 198.3, a party that's looking to move to withdraw deemed admissions has to show good cause for the withdrawal or the amendment, which has been interpreted to mean accident or mistake, not conscious indifference, and they have to show that the parties relying on those deemed admissions won't be unduly prejudiced if they're withdrawn. In that circumstance, a trial court may, and the word that the legislature chose was may, allow the admissions to be withdrawn. So it's not... The
legislature didn't promulgate that rule.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. You're correct. My apologies. when the rule was promulgated, the decision was made to include the permissive language may. And so when it comes to merit preclusive admissions, and we do agree that these admissions do relate directly to the elements of the claims, the question becomes, how does that conscious disregard bad faith standard factor into the pre-existing abusive discretion standard?
Does conscious disregard come into play if someone has a mental impairment?
I believe that it can. I absolutely believe that it can. And I could speculate on a number of circumstances where that might be the case. I believe that the facts of this case, though, are quite different and actually quite egregious from the standpoint of STI being a claimant and intervening in an existing lawsuit in November of 2016 and taking no steps for nearly a full year to prosecute its claim. That's a long time for the cloud of litigation to be hanging over the heads of two other parties. The record does show that the parties moved to have the claims involving STI severed out into a separate cause so that they could get moving on those claims and get some resolution of those claims, and that was when the request for admissions were sent. I believe the briefing to the trial court indicates that they were submitted because the parties wanted to know what was in dispute. And this plaintiff, STI, who brought the claims and intervened in the case, had not done anything for a year, hadn't served discovery, hadn't set a trial date, hadn't taken any steps to prosecute its claim. And the defendants are sitting there in the position of, we have this litigation hanging over our heads. GCRE and LCAR in particular have liens on encumbering their property and inhibiting their ability to realize the potential proceeds from that property, and they can't do anything. They're hamstrung because the plaintiff is not prosecuting its case. And so they sent these requests for admissions, hoping that it would get something going, they would find out what was in dispute, and they heard nothing. But it turns out that the appellees were not the only ones in that boat, because STI also was in that boat. We know from the record that Mr. Tagmeier had stopped communicating with STI in May of 2017. And that's at the record on page CR 531, the sworn statement of STI's managers, that as of May, their attorney had gone radio silent. In June, we know that it caused STI enough concern to go out and seek new attorneys and find out what do they need to do. So Mr. Abreu contacted prior counsel Jennifer Edgeworth for GCRE and LCAR and indicated that he, quote, will be appearing for STI shortly, end quote. He sent that email, as Justice Kerr noted earlier, at the end of June. And so,
is there some sort of duty for them to sign on as counsel prior to November?
Well, I don't think it turns on whether or not they had an ethical duty to appear promptly. I think the question is whether or not STI was paying attention to its case. And I apologize.
So you're attributing this now to the client. This is the client's conscious indifference.
At this stage, yes. Mm-hmm. At this stage, yes. The record doesn't indicate what authority Mr. Abreu had in June, only that it was his intention to appear shortly. So at this stage, we've moved from Mr. Tagmeier's not paying attention to the case to now here we are in May, June, and July of 2017. STI's not paying any attention to its case. They've talked to this new lawyer, but they haven't caused this new lawyer to appear, and they're not paying any attention. And I apologize that I didn't cite this case in my brief. It wasn't until I went back and took another look at it that I realized how similar it was. But it was the case that this court decided in 2010, Gordon v. Brunig. The Westlaw citation is 2010 Westlaw 1999313. And the court talked about the fact that the trial court could have reasonably concluded that the attorney in that case was just simply choosing not to pay attention to the litigation matter where the request for admissions had been served and not.
In that case, how long had they not paid attention?
I believe in that case,
because we're talking here July, August, September, 5 months.
Yes, I believe in that case he had taken a vacation and filed a different appellate brief, and I don't recall the exact amount of time that the admissions were overlooked.
Because you don't have to pay attention every day to your case. So there has to be a temporal analysis done on how long. That's why I ask.
I completely agree, Your Honor. And in terms of what the record shows in this particular case, STI knew that their attorney wasn't paying attention in May. They took some steps in June and July to try to get new counsel, but they didn't have that new counsel appear. And what I find actually really quite curious that the record doesn't answer is the fact that Mr. Abreu's firm filed its notice of appearance on November the 9th of 2017. That's CR 362 to 63. And according to his affidavit, he did that because he discovered that the motions for summary judgment had been filed. So someone at his firm was monitoring or looking at the docket and came upon the summary judgment motions, and suddenly that spurred Mr. Abreu to enter an appearance in the case. So at some point, clearly...
Well, shouldn't they be applauded for that rather than have that held against them? If that's the scenario, that's the hypothetical you pose.
Well, I think it goes to whether or not STI and its counsel were diligently prosecuting its case and paying attention to it. And I think that what's similar to the Gordon case is that in this case, the trial court could have concluded from looking at this record that STI and its prior counsel and its new counsel just simply weren't paying any attention to this case and had conscious disregard for this case. If you look at the motion for continuance, the trial court gave STI numerous opportunities to seek to withdraw their deemed admissions. The first request that they made was not supported by any evidence. They realized that that was an issue. They moved for continuance of the summary judgment hearing, and then filed an amended motion. But that amended motion was also flawed. And just returning back to the text of the Rule 198.3, a movement seeking to withdraw deemed admissions has to show good cause and has to show that the other parties won't be unduly prejudiced.
Okay, so tell me what the undue prejudice is. I read in the brief that you wouldn't have won the summary judgment if they had been undeemed. But that's not the standard. The standard's not whether you win or lose. The standard is something over and above the merits of the case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
so what is the undue prejudice?
The undue prejudice, specifically as to GCR and LCAR, is the fact that they have what they believe to be invalid liens encumbering their property, and they've been in litigation to resolve the issue for a full year, and the other side's not participating, not engaging, not timely responding to the trial court's invitation to submit amended pleadings. The trial court gave STI until, I believe it was November 30th, to provide amended responses to the summary judgment motion, and once again, they were a day late.
And those invalid liens now, at this point in time, when the court is hearing the motion to undeem admissions, those invalid liens, as you characterize them, encumbering their property, had been pending for how long?
The record may speak to that, Your Honor. I could take a minute to look it up if it's material. I believe the record does speak to that in the original motion for summary judgment.
Years, months, days?
I would have to look at the motion, the original summary judgment motion, Your Honor. I apologize. That escapes my memory at the moment.
Ms. Ross, may I ask you a question?
Of course.
You want to look that up?
I'd be glad to.
I can look it up.
I just find it quickly.
That's fine. Go ahead and answer Justice Meyer's question.
These requests for admissions were filed, according to your oral argument, in order to assess the status of the case. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that the pleadings to the trial court indicated that they served them because the case had been pending for 9 months at that point, and they wanted to know what was in dispute.
Do you agree that these requests for admissions are result determinative requests for admissions?
I don't think there's any question they go directly to the merits of the claims. Otherwise, they wouldn't have supported a summary judgment. So yes.
At least the appellees knew when they drafted these request for admissions about what was necessary in order to resolve the case.
They knew the issues, yes, of the claims. They were not sure what facts were in dispute. For example, the existence of a contract. Sometimes parties concede there's a contract but disagree over what it means. Other times parties don't agree that there's a contract. So if you send admissions on the elements of the claims, it can be a useful tool to figure out what it is in the case.
I agree about what can be useful. I would ask you do you agree that these requests for admissions are result determinative in nature?
If I understand the court correctly, I believe the answer to your question is yes, that the admissions do
They were result determinative, weren't they?
Yes. They supported a summary judgment, so they couldn't be otherwise.
And do you agree that there should be a more stringent review and perhaps a stronger test for determining the issue of allowing the withdrawal of the deemed admissions when the admissions are result determinative and essentially provide a death penalty for the party that's failed to answer timely?
Of course. And I believe that the Texas Supreme Court has handled that in saying that it's an abuse of discretion to deny a motion under 198.3 if the other side can't show bad faith or conscious disregard.
Do you find any authority in your research for the fact that whenever the attorney for the party who's had the admissions deemed against them is under stress and suffering from mental illness, that the admissions should not be set aside?
I did not find any cases with that particular fact pattern. Chronological point.
Do you suppose maybe it's because the trial courts have been handling those kinds of issues for years now?
I'm sure they have, Your Honor, and I believe that that's well within their discretion. And I think that on, in particular, a few of the facts in this record, the trial court here acted within its discretion in deciding not to allow STI to withdraw its deemed admissions. For example, if you look at the chronology of the key events in STI's appellant brief, I believe it's at page 10. What's not found there is any description of what Mr. Tagmeier was doing during the very specific time period between when the requests were served and when they were answered. But we can fill in that gap using other things in the record. For example, Mr. Tagmeier says that during that exact same time period, he was serving as an arbitrator in two separate cases. Now, that's far and above simply opening an email and calendaring a deadline. And so we believe that the record shows not that Mr. Tagmeier was unable to attend to the case, but that the trial court could have reasonably concluded that Mr. Tagmeier simply failed to pay attention to the case and demonstrated the conscious indifference that precludes a finding of good faith under Rule 198.3. There's also no evidence in the record that the hurricane impacted Mr. Tagmeier's work. In fact, in the first motion to withdraw admissions, Hurricane Harvey wasn't even mentioned. They didn't even attribute anything to that. So it appeared that as the case became more desperate, STI tried to come up with additional reasons why no attention was paid to the request for admissions at the time that they were served. But again, I don't believe that Mr. Tagmeier's conduct is solely dispositive. The plaintiff has an obligation to diligently prosecute its case, and for 9 months did not do anything. And for 3 months between the time that Mr. Tagmeier stopped communicating with them and the time that the requests for admissions were served, they didn't take any steps to get new counsel. Now, I completely agree with Justice Sutterth that they weren't required to pay attention to the case every day. No one can pay attention to a case every single day. But 3 months is a very long time to have a case where you believe you're entitled to money and your lawyer's not responding to you and you've taken no steps to get another attorney to appear in that case to make sure that something doesn't happen that would prejudice your rights. So this doesn't turn on Mr. Tagmeier's mental health. He has my every sympathy. But I don't believe that the record shows that he was so impaired during the relevant time period that he couldn't have attended to the emails and certified mail that he received notifying him of the request for admissions. And regardless, he was representing a client who knew he wasn't paying attention.
So your belief is that while you're on your way to inspect buildings to determine a place where you can jump off and commit suicide, you ought to be thinking about answering these requests for admissions.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't believe that that chronology lines up with my recollection of the record. I don't believe it was until October or November that Mr. Tagmeier's mental health grew to that level of intensity and
he just concern. He just was getting there. He wasn't there yet.
The record doesn't really tell us what was going on for Mr. Tagmeier, except that he was arbitrating cases and dealing with the hurricane.
A case.
Two cases, Your Honor. I believe it was two separate cases. That's at page 527 of the record. And so I don't believe the record is conclusively establishing what Mr. Tagmeier's condition was, but it really doesn't matter when he hasn't been communicating with his client for 4 months and they've done nothing to try to get counsel involved in the case that can protect and prosecute their claim. I see that my time is up, so if the court does not have any additional questions, thank you very much for your attention today.
Thank you.
The arguments proffered by the appellees should be judged by one of the arguments that counsel just made, namely that our firm somehow also messed up. And she points to the fact that we filed a pleading one day late after we made an appearance. And that's really not an issue on the appeal, but we filed a motion for leave and explained that while in court, when that hearing was scheduled, Mr. Abreu wrote it in his calendar. I have the original attached in the record at 8:03 is a blow-up picture. He wrote it on the wrong day. We filed for leave, and the court signed an order at 8:18 granting us leave to file the pleading one day late. So that isn't really an issue, but they keep coming back to it to somehow illustrate or bootstrap that somehow we're not paying attention to the case. An honest mistake, sometimes cases get snake bit. It just seems to be that way. And in this case, that was just one of those snake bite things. But make no mistake, and Justice Meyer, I think you're right on it. These admissions were not sent to what we've been waiting for 9 months and we wanted to know what was issued. No, they knew that opposing counsel had been radio silent. They knew that our firm had contacted them about perhaps subbing in. So what did they do? They quickly formulated these requests for admissions.
Well, is it not also possible that they sent the request for admissions to try to get things off dead center?
Well, getting them off dead center wouldn't necessitate questions like STI did not fully perform under the contract, STI did not substantially perform under the contract, did not timely perform, did not perform all conditions precedent. That's a legal conclusion. There's a case that's cited by both parties, CAFA decision, which says that you cannot base a summary judgment based upon deemed admissions that are legal conclusions. They have no evidentiary effect. But nevertheless, they ask us, STI breached the contract. Our friends at GCR, that was RISE, GCRE asked those same and added two or three extra ones, including one that there was no contract. GCRE says, there's not a contract with us. The judge granted a summary judgment on that deemed admission when he had our response in front of him with two contracts signed by these parties. And that's the problem. This was a gotcha deal. The lawyers for those folks knew he was incommunicado. Let's send these requests for admissions out. We'll get them deemed. We'll move for summary judgment. And so when you start aiming at my firm that did everything it could do to try to get this thing on righted and going, you have to look at what really happened. And that's and what makes it worse is when they found out the real reason, no one backed off. The court's order is defective under Transamerican and under Rule 215 because it must recite the guiding principles that it decided not whether this court should follow, but rather it has to make findings. And it has to include a lesser included possibility. If you look at the order, the lesser included was in it, the proposed order, and he marked it out.
And I apologize for not having the particular case right in front of me, but I thought I saw something in the briefing that suggested that granting a summary judgment on deemed admissions is not exactly like a death penalty sanction. Did I see a case that said that?
I've not seen that. There are cases, Stelly, out of the Texas Supreme Court and other cases that view that very, I think Sire actually, hold on a second. There's a laundry list in one of the cases, Your Honor, and I'll, if the court would like, I'll identify the case and email or send a letter to the court with that case where it runs that laundry list where deemed admissions, where the deemed admission is merit preclusive, is considered a death penalty sanction. And when you don't allow a party to withdraw those sanctions in the face of summary judgment evidence which directly refutes the deemed admissions, contracts, liens, amount owed, you are in effect creating a death penalty sanction, and it must go under that analysis. And with all due respect, this is one of those that, to me, it shouldn't be a close call. The judge just missed it. He should have stepped back and said, okay, you guys, y'all, this, they're complaining about the delay. What do we need to do? I'm going to impose some monetary sanction, and then we're going to set this summary judgment, which you've now responded to, for hearing. It wouldn't have been granted, but he would have set the case for trial. I see my time is up. I apologize to the court for going over. We respectfully request the court reverse the trial court's decision on the summary judgments and order the court to enter an order undeeming those admissions and permitting the case to proceed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counselors, we thank you so much for your argument. It's been very helpful. We appreciate your coming here today. Your case has been now submitted, and you're free to go about your business. Thank you.